It's a real pleasure to welcome Dan Green as our colloquium speaker this week. Dan is a very well-known figure in the cosmology and particle physics communities. He's also a good friend to us here in Canada. He got his PhD from Stanford in 2009, and then he was a postdoc at the IIS in Princeton, and also postdoc at Stanford, before he joined the faculty at CETA in Toronto back in 2014. And then sadly for us, the lure of California weather was too strong, and Dan then moved back to California a few years ago. And he's been at UC San Diego as faculty since 2017, I think. So Dan works on pretty much everything interesting related to the early universe, cosmic microwave background, large scale structure, you know, basically all the interesting topics in cosmology. And today, so his plan is to tell us about some interesting work he did this past year on looking for signals of a quantum universe. So Dan, whenever you're ready, please feel free to take it away.
Okay, well, thanks so much for the overly kind introduction. I should make one correction, which was that I actually really would like to have stayed in Toronto. It's my family whose lure to California was stronger. But in any case, I also am very sad that the original plan was for me to visit in person in March, which was, I guess, not meant to be. But I look forward to a day where I can come visit in person again, because I really enjoyed my time in the Ontario area. Okay, so today I'm going to tell you all about signals of a quantum universe. This is based on a paper that came out this year, but I'll give some background. So my plan is that first I'm going to review why inflation is necessary, or something like it, in the early universe. Then we'll describe, you know, what is inflation, try to understand the physics of inflation in a general way, and the role that quantum mechanics plays in the success of inflation. This will lead us to Bell tests and their cosmic analogs, and then we'll end by talking about signals of a quantum universe. Okay, so we look out on the universe on a variety, we see structures on a variety of scales. We see things like stars and planets and galaxies. We see the distribution of matter and collapsed objects on enormous cosmological scales. And ultimately, all the way back to the cosmic microwave background, where we see structure in the fluctuations in temperature across the sky. Now, we ultimately believe all of these structures have a common origin in the very early universe. And our best understanding of that has been driven by the cosmic microwave background for over 50 years. The cosmic microwave background is a snapshot of the universe around 380,000 years after the Big Bang. This is the moment when hydrogen became neutral, so protons, free protons and electrons combined to form neutral hydrogen, allowing light to finally free stream, and it more or less free streams to us, giving us a picture of what the universe was like at that time. Now, the cosmic microwave background was first observed in 1965 by Penzias and Wilson. And what they saw in terms of pictures like this was just a uniform temperature across the sky of approximately 3 Kelvin. Relatively quickly, they were able to observe the dipole, which is really just a reflection of our relative motion compared to the rest frame of the cosmic microwave background. But it's about a 1 part in 1,000 measurement of this temperature. Nothing more was seen in the structure of the CMB for a long time, but even by the 70s, just these two observations alone presented a serious problem for cosmology. In particular, this uniform temperature across the sky demands an explanation that's not available in the standard Big Bang cosmology. In particular, the distance that light travels in this 380,000 years from the Big Bang until recombination is much smaller than the scales that are observed across the sky. So in particular, when we look at regions separated by more than 2 degrees on the sky, there's no particular reason that the temperature should have had this, should be the same in this conventional cosmology. Thermal equilibrium isn't enough to explain where this came from. So The solution proposed by Guth was to change the history of the universe from this conventional Big Bang picture. So in 1980, he proposed this idea of inflation. The simplest incarnation of the simplest way to think about this is, in some sense, just adding more time in the past to give light time to travel across the observable universe during this inflationary era. The way in which Guth accomplished this was taking advantage of exponential expansion that occurs in a de Sitter-like universe. So in particular, you imagine that the expansion of the universe grows like e to the ht, where h is a constant, which is also the Hubble parameter during inflation. And it means that points that were nearby are stretched to distances exponentially quickly, when what sets the scale of causality is the Hubble scale, the natural curvature scale during this period. So points that started in close enough to exchange information are quickly stretched to points that are far apart. And this exponential expansion is what makes it possible for these different points to have a causal origin in the past, even if they apparently don't have a causal origin when we look at it. Now, the problem with Guth's original model is that you ultimately need to end this period and reheat the universe and start the hot Big Bang. So just a pure de Sitter-like solution, something with a positive cosmological constant, doesn't accomplish the job. We need to have some way of ending this period. And this was what Linde and separately Albrecht and Steinhardt came up with in 1982. They found a way to end this period of inflation and restart the hot Big Bang by introducing a scalar field. So for this audience, many of you already know, but just so we are all on the same page, a scalar field is just a number that varies from point to point and also evolves in time. So it's a number at every given point in space that evolves according to some kind of equations of motion. So a simple example is the temperature on Earth. Okay, every point on Earth has some temperature, and the evolution of the temperature, say here in San Diego or in Waterloo, evolves according to a very complex set of equations that we solve on supercomputers to predict the weather. Now, the scalar fields we use that were introduced by Linde and Albrecht and Steinhardt are much simpler than the temperature on Earth. Instead, this is a scalar field that at any given point evolves according to equations of motion that are the same mathematically as the mechanical model of a ball rolling down a hill. So the shape of this hill is given by some potential, V of phi, and locally we can understand the solutions to the evolution of the scalar field just by our same intuition for what a ball would do on this rolling on this potential. So what they proposed was that this ball starts at the top of some hill that's very flat and is rolling along. In this regime, the energy of density of the universe is dominated by the potential energy of this ball. And that potential energy is what drives the expansion of the universe, giving a nearly constant Hubble parameter, or alternatively, the exponential growth that we want in the to allow for inflation to operate. However, eventually, the ball converts this potential energy into kinetic energy and starts rolling quickly. And now the Hubble parameter is no longer a constant, as the time evolution of this ball makes it start to look effectively like matter as we convert this potential energy to kinetic energy. Finally, we convert this kinetic energy into radiation, restarting the universe, the hot Big Bang, and filling a universe with a hot gas, which has some temperature which dominates the energy density. And now the Hubble parameter decays like 1/(scale factor) of the universe, the expansion parameter of the universe to the fourth, as in the conventional hot Big Bang. Built into inflation is the potential to create structure. So while the initial idea was to just have one uniform scalar field that's the same everywhere in space, scalar fields can fluctuate. And so if different points started or evolved in slightly different ways, then the amount of inflation from point to point in space would be slightly different. This would mean that the amount of dilution of energy density from the expansion of the universe would be different from place to place, corresponding to a fluctuation in the energy density of the universe from place to place. The way in which this actually occurs is due to the expansion of the universe. So there are vacuum fluctuations of the scalar field in the quantum vacuum, but this exponential expansion of the background stretches these quantum fluctuations until they become classical fluctuations in a picture something like this. So from this model, by around 1985, this model of slow roll inflation had made a number of predictions. The universe on the largest possible scales would look homogeneous and isotropic. It would look the same at every point and in every direction. And the geometry of this universe should look spatially flat. On top of this, there were fluctuations. These fluctuations were adiabatic, meaning that they affected all the energy densities in the same way because it's just this variation in how much dilution happens from the expansion of the universe. In addition, because this era of inflation looks approximately the same in any given time, the fluctuations turn out to be nearly scale invariant. And finally, because of the flatness of this potential, the fluctuations are very close to Gaussian. In addition, there were similar predictions for gravitational waves. Now, it wasn't until 1992 that we actually started to see evidence of this structure that we anticipate that we know needs to be there from structure in the later universe. So Kobe first measured this variation in the cosmic microwave background at one part in 100,000. Was quickly followed up by a number of smaller experiments, culminating in Boomerang, which was really the first to pin down a lot of these cosmological parameters. Over the next two decades, the cosmic microwave background was measured across the sky in increasing resolution by WMAP and Planck, which is roughly where we are today. Now, with these all-sky maps, what we do is we can now look at the power in these fluctuations on different scales, and I'm sure many of you have seen this plot of the power as a function of angular scale. And we see this beautiful acoustic structure of peaks and troughs. Now, this structure is itself a much more stringent need for something like inflation in the early universe. In particular, what this structure is a snapshot of sound waves propagating in the early universe. But what we're doing when we look at this plot is averaging over a bunch of different sound waves with the same wavelength, but moving in different directions. So the fact that when we add up or we average over all these sound waves, we get this coherent structure tells us that all of these sound waves are coming in phase. In particular, that this variation in temperature corresponds to a pure cosine with no sine component. If we imagine that structure in the universe was created around the time of recombination, this absence of any variation phase would seem like an incredible fine-tuning. However, so this is the short wavelength behavior where these things look like sound waves oscillating in time. But if we imagine that the fluctuations were not created around the time of during the hot Big Bang, but were instead had an origin at much earlier times with extremely long wavelengths, then the absence of the sine wave is naturally a result of dynamics. So in particular, when we look at wavelengths that are very long compared to the size of the observable universe at that time, the solutions don't oscillate, but instead behave like a constant or a piece that decays to zero. This piece decay is like 1/1 the volume of the universe. And so this ultimately becomes the coefficient of this sign. So if we postulate that something like inflation gave rise to these fluctuations, then naturally the evolution on these large scales forces you into a situation where the phase is coherent. Also, it'll become relevant later in the talk, so remember this fact that one of these solutions decays to zero. As a result, the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, or cosmology in general, have the following factorized structure. There are amplitudes, that are random and given by the physics of inflation or whatever mechanism you would like for the production of structure. And then it's multiplied by some piece that depends on the physics of recombination, the sound waves that are propagating in this plasma. And because of this factorized structure, we can actually make incredibly precise measurements of both the physics of inflation and the physics of this plasma separately, so that we nail down all of the physics of both simultaneously. Right now, these parameters are measured at one part in 1,000 and have given incredible agreement with these predictions of slow roll inflation. So does this confirm slow roll inflation? So in 1985, we had predicted what the power spectrum should look like, or the statistics of the cosmic background should look like, and we're now finding great agreement with those predictions. However, a lot has happened since those early days of inflation. Goose paper's been cited 8,000 times, corresponding to something like 8,000 different models with different mechanisms for producing the structure, but yet often giving very similar predictions. Given this vast landscape of possibilities, we should revisit the question of what really is inflation and how do we test the framework of inflation? For the purpose of this talk, I'm going to give the following definition of inflation. It's really two pieces. The first is that it's an approximately De Sitter solution. What this means is that the expansion is very close to exponential, or that the Hubble parameter is very close to a constant. The second condition is that the universe was filled with some kind of physical clock. This clock is needed to end inflation, and in these slow roll models, the roll of the clock is the scalar field. So this first condition is really Goose's original insight. The insight that exponential expansion gives you the possibility of explaining why our entire observable universe had some causal origin in the past by extending the geometry of the universe prior to what naively would have been the Big Bang. The second condition is really the insight of Linde, Albrecht, and Szilard. We can understand the need for this clock in the following sense. If inflation ends at a given time, then that time has some meaning. But we know that in general relativity, there's no such thing as time without a clock to measure it. So if we're going to say that there was a time at which inflation ended everywhere in the universe, then that time must be the result of some physical clock. The way that inflation works, then, is that we synchronized our clocks in the past. Back when every point in space was in causal, that we observe today had some causal contact, we synchronized our clocks at those times. Exponential expansion stretches those clocks apart, so they're no longer in causal contact. But because we synchronized them in the past, they all remember to say, when our clock strikes 12, we all end inflation, and we can end inflation across the universe nearly simultaneously. Now, of course, when phrased this way, we know that it can't be exactly simultaneous because there's no such thing as a perfect clock. At the very least, we have the uncertainty principle that tells you that we can't measure time perfectly accurately. As a result, different points in space, these different clocks will have some error. They won't all agree with each other. There'll be some error in their measurement of time, which will translate into a different amount of expansion from place to place. The variation of the error in our measurement of time is proportional usually to two quantities. One is the expansion rate, Hubble. This is because the production of these quantum fluctuations becoming physical is really proportional to the expansion rate itself. Without expansion, we wouldn't have these classical fluctuations. But in addition, we need some energy scale f pi, just on dimensionful grounds. We need some scale f pi. And this scale is really like, it's what sets the ticks of our clock, or what sets the resolution of our measurement of time. So there's some scale out there that tells us how accurately we're measuring time given some error h. In slow roll, this scale is played by the speed at which the scalar field rolls. So the faster the scalar field rolls, the smaller the uncertainty in time for a fixed change in the initial conditions of phi. This variation from place to place in the amount of expansion is more or less what we observe on the sky in terms of the variation in temperature up to some transfer function, again, due to the physics of these sound waves. So when we think of, say, measuring multiple points on the CMB sky, we can think of that as being the same as making statistical measurements of the error in the amount of expansion from point to point in the universe. Now, given this definition, it's natural to ask what kind of clocks are possible to describe the inflationary universe. In the real world, we certainly don't make clocks out of fundamental scalar fields. In addition, clocks in the real world are affected by other kinds of noise, most notably thermal noise, and not just the uncertainty principle. So is it possible that the early universe was governed by some totally different kind of clock, subject to classical thermal fluctuations, where the quantum fluctuations are more or less absent? If so, can we tell the difference between that and the quantum mechanical scenario? Now, we should always be cautious when favoring the quantum mechanical scenario because it has such an appealing character to it. There's a catchphrase you could explain for why the origin of structure from quantum mechanics is a nice explanation, because it ties together the biggest structures in the universe, the origin of things like clusters of galaxies, with physics of the microscopic, quantum mechanics on the smallest possible scale. But we should be worried that our desire for such a beautiful explanation is not the one that the universe prefers, and we should ask if we can test this idea observationally. Now, naturally, you might ask if Bell solved this problem for us. Bell's inequalities are this nice way of testing the possibility of classical probability versus quantum probability. But what Bell tells us how to do is to tell if a given state is quantum mechanical. If when we make measurements on a given system, quantum mechanics is governing that system at the time we measure it. Now, the universe we observe is for all practical purposes classical. And what we actually want to know is whether quantum mechanics was important in the past, not whether it's important in the present. And that's the fundamental challenge that we're gonna try to deal with the rest of this talk. Okay, so to start, let's review how Bell's inequalities work to understand why they're problematic in as a tool for cosmology. So fundamentally, what Bell's inequalities are about is that there are two kinds of probability that occur in the physical world. There's quantum mechanical probability, where I assign a complex number to a certain set of, for each possibility. And when I want to compute the probability that some particular outcome is measured, I add up all of those complex numbers and take the absolute value squared. In contrast, in classical physics, I assign the probability of a given possibility a number between 0 and 1, so a real number between 0 and 1. And if there are multiple ways to get a given outcome, I determine the probability of that outcome by adding up these probabilities. So instead of adding and taking the absolute value squared, I just add real numbers. And these two types of probability are the two things that we're trying to tell apart when we're looking at Bell's inequalities. Now, in classical probability, we can think of these probabilities as really just an uncertainty in our knowledge of the system. So in particular, if I have multiple paths leading to multiple outcomes, and I measure one of them, it's consistent for me to have imagined that that one path was what happened all along. I was always in this one physical configuration. I just didn't know ahead of time which one it was. And I need a measurement to decide which of these possible paths the universe chose. In quantum mechanics, in a certain sense, the same is true only when you're looking at an observable that commutes with a Hamiltonian. So one could choose to look at a given observable in this sense. I start with a certain set of possibilities, and then I evolve each one, and then I ask which one I'm in. The true difference of quantum mechanics comes when now we look at a measurement that doesn't commute. In particular, I'm free to measure a different quantity, say some other observable that doesn't commute with my first observable, It's now, I can no longer diagonalize both problems at the same time. And one of these measurements has to come in terms of this different kind of probability, this quantum mechanics rule for probability, where I have possible interference between these different paths. And the fact that I can choose which one of these observables, which basis of operators I observe in, is what forces the problem to reflect the quantum mechanical probability. Now, specifically, the setup for Bell that makes this most clean is to look at a system where I split into two systems that are potentially entangled, both of which are measuring discrete numbers, plus or minus one. I split the system off, and I assume that measurements here commute with measurements here. But at either the blue system or the red system, I can measure in a prime or unprimed basis. Now, the key for Bell's inequality is that I'm free to choose which basis I measure in. I get to decide which one. And for the quantum mechanical version of this problem, I assume that these bases don't commute. As a result, when I make a measurement in A basis or the A prime basis, the rules for the probability are going to reflect the quantum mechanical rule because I can't diagonalize the problem simultaneously. Nevertheless, when I do this measurement, I always return plus or minus one in either basis. And so by combining measurements on the A system and the B system in this clever way, I'll get an answer that depends on whether it's the quantum mechanical system with the non-zero commutator or the classical statistical system where the commutator is zero. The natural question then is, can I apply the same idea in cosmology? The simplest implementation would be to go to the CMB and imagine looking in different directions. Then we make measurements, say in one direction, in some set of bases, either A or A prime, in some different direction, B or B prime, and I construct this kind of observable that's supposed to reflect the fact that this is some quantum state. Now, when you try these sort of direct applications of Bell, you'll find that the answer is suppressed by an enormous number. 10 to the minus 115 is sort of the invariant number you end up with. This isn't just practically impossible, it's literally impossible to measure a number this small, given the finite amount of information that's available in our observable universe. So what's the problem? The problem is directly tied to this feature we discussed before, namely that there's only one real solution that we observe on the sky. In particular, the key to measuring the quantum state is to measure a non-zero commutator. The difference between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics lives entirely in this non-zero commutator. So the only way we're going to be able to test it is with something that doesn't commute. Given a field with two real solutions combined in this way to form a complex number, the commutator is proportional to the product of these two solutions. But now we remember this fact about observations, which was to explain how the universe evolved. It was important that one of these solutions is driven to zero, like one over the volume of the universe. As a result, the commutator is suppressed by the volume of the universe, which is an incredibly small, which makes this commutator incredibly small, which is therefore why we can't observe it. We can also track this fact just to basic causality. In particular, given two points that are at the same time, the commutator has to vanish outside the light cone, and writing that in a way that makes sense with diffeomorphism invariance requires that this delta function is always suppressed by this volume factor. Altogether, what this means is, on completely general grounds, what we're observing in cosmology is just this quantity, correlation functions of the field zeta, and not a quantity that doesn't commute with it. As a result, we can think of everything we observe as just computing correlation functions with the absolute value squared of the wave function, but we might as well just replace that absolute value squared of the wave function with a classical probability distribution, because it makes no difference whether I call it the wave function or a probability distribution, unless I can measure a non-commuting observable. Okay, so now we're gonna see how to overcome this problem. Okay, so as we stated before, the central issue here is that we can replace the absolute value squared of the wave function with a classical probability distribution and reproduce all of the observables. So our hope then is to find that the set of probability distributions that we can get from quantum mechanics is different than the set of probability distributions that come from classical dynamics. So instead of just focusing on whether we have a wave function or a classical probability distribution, we're going to focus on the space of possible probability distributions that can arise given a complete history being either quantum mechanical or classical in terms of the dynamics. In order to do that, we have to think about how we generate these probability distributions in the first place. The idea here is that what we want is that the Hamiltonian itself is going to play the role of the Bell measurement. So in particular, we're going to imagine doing a measurement in some basis that doesn't commute with the Hamiltonian. As a result, the Hamiltonian will, not commuting with his observable, will effectively do the job of forcing the probability to reflect this quantum mechanical origin. And that we won't be able to find a classical evolution that gives the same probability distribution. Now, it's not a priori obvious that this works. That the Hamiltonian can do the job of Bell is not necessarily something that you might think would survive in cosmology. But a proof of principle was demonstrated by Maldacena in 2015. The key idea was just to roughly perform a Bell measurement during inflation instead of trying to do it in the universe after. Now, this model is highly contrived. It literally introduces spin degrees of freedom in addition to the inflaton and effectively has those spin degrees of freedom interact in such a way to perform a Bell measurement and then store the information of that Bell measurement in the mass of certain particles, which then leave hot and cold spots in the cosmic microwave background. Regardless, what this shows is that the hot and cold spots in this CMB reflect a Bell inequality and thus couldn't have been possible if these A and B observables commuted. On the other hand, it's not a very useful observational test because we can only know if those hot and cold spots perform a Bell inequality if we already knew that this was the correct model of the universe. In particular, this only accomplishes the goal in this very finely tuned specific model. Instead, what we want is to find a more generic possibility, a way of telling whether a typical model of inflation was produced by quantum instead of classical fluctuations. So to do this, we're going to go back to this basic difference between classical and quantum physics to try to isolate this key difference and see if it propagates through the statistics. So recall that in classical physics, probabilities really just reflect uncertainty, our uncertainty in which of the classical possibilities occurred. What this means is that the fluctuations were always physical. We just didn't know which one was chosen by the history of the universe. But classical fluctuations are really sines and cosines. They're real degrees of freedom. So we have a real density fluctuation that are characterized by sines and cosines, and we just don't know the amplitude and phase of those sines and cosines. On the other hand, vacuum fluctuations aren't physical until much later times. In flat space, for example, it's not until we make a measurement of the vacuum that we can see these fluctuations. What describes quantum mechanical fluctuations are instead positive and negative frequency modes characterizing the energy above the vacuum that's created to make a physical fluctuation. And it's this key difference between sines and cosines and positive and negative frequencies that we're interested in using to distinguish the two types of probability. Now, as we said before, the inflation predicts mostly Gaussian fluctuations. And so let's start by asking if the Gaussian statistics alone can characterize the quantum nature of the state. Now, a Gaussian distribution is entirely determined by two-point statistics. So in particular, looking at two points on the CMB sky and comparing the temperature at those different points as a function of distance encodes all of the information about a Gaussian probability distribution. We can think of this Gaussian probability distribution in terms of, from both the quantum and classical model, in terms of the following decomposition. So we imagine we have our statistical or quantum mechanical field zeta, which describes this difference in the expansion. And we break it up into positive and negative frequencies, as we would in the quantum mechanical case. So these are just classical solutions. The zeta and zeta star of K are just classical solutions corresponding to time evolution with a positive frequency or a negative frequency. The difference between quantum and classical is then encoded in the amplitude of these modes, the A and A dagger. In quantum physics, these are operators. The A dagger creates a particle from the vacuum, and the A annihilates the vacuum. This gives rise to the two-point statistics via a particular ordering of A and A dagger, while the opposite ordering annihilates the vacuum and gives zero. And the difference between these two things is precisely the fact these variables don't commute. In classical physics, instead, these are just random numbers. They're real, they're classical statistical variables, but they're not operators. So they commute with each other, and they just have some two-point statistics according to how we draw them from a distribution. But with this factor of two, this classical model and this quantum mechanical model give the same Gaussian correlators in cosmology. So what about non-Gaussian correlators? The simplest non-Gaussian correlator we could think of is, say, the three-point statistics. So now we imagine taking 3 points on the cosmic microwave background and comparing the temperature at those different points as a function of the relative distance between the points. We can also think of this in Fourier space in terms of this variable zeta as a three-point function between different Fourier modes. Now, here we're going to need to make some assumptions about how this non-Gaussian probability distribution arises. If I just stick the non-Gaussianity in the initial conditions, so I pick some initial state with some non-local non-Gaussian correlators, then of course I can reproduce the final probability distribution. But this, of course, isn't interesting because I haven't explained where this non-Gaussian statistics comes from. So instead, what we're going to assume is that the non-Gaussian statistics can be explained by Hamiltonian evolution, or particularly, in particular, non-linear evolution. Furthermore, what we're hoping for is that we can find some feature of the resulting non-Gaussian correlators that doesn't depend in detail on how the nonlinear, the precise type of nonlinearity. Instead, we want something generic, something that a feature that survives independent of the precise microphysics that's involved. This is what distinguishes this idea from the Maldacena model from 2015, where so we're forbidding the possibility of just adding arbitrarily complicated dynamics that will implement a Bell measurement. This desire to have something that doesn't depend on the details is, for example, what distinguishes solving this problem in cosmology with, say, a related type problem in quantum computing. We're not allowed to, we don't get to fiddle with the code to force some outcome that displays the desired result. The simplest way to see how this works is then to just work out examples and extract the general lessons. So we'll consider some cubic interaction. The details of this interaction are not going to matter, but some cubic coupling that connects the different Fourier modes of this adiabatic density fluctuation. A standard calculation for this three-point statistic has the following structure. The details, again, don't matter. We only want to focus on this piece, which we call the total energy pole. This total energy pole is really just a reflection of energy conservation. In particular, if instead of a cosmological correlator, I was calculating a scattering process, I would have a delta function corresponding to energy conservation, that the sum of energies has to equal zero. Now, this process, this three-point function we're measuring in cosmology, corresponds to creation of three particles from nothing. It's a vacuum fluctuation. So we started in a vacuum with no particles and produced three fluctuations from nothing. In a scattering process, this would be impossible. It would violate energy conservation. But because this is just a correlation function, and we're producing these fluctuations through the uncertainty principle, instead it's just suppressed by the amount of energy I have to borrow from the universe to create these three particles, giving rise to this total energy pool. Now, the power of this sum of energies is model dependent, but the fact that I get some structure of the sum of energies is as model independent as the feature of a delta function in scattering processes. In fact, this connection with scattering is even sharper. The residue of this pole, or more stated differently, the numerator in this expression is actually the flat space scattering amplitude. So the details of scattering, the microphysics that gives rise to different scattering amplitudes, is all encoded in the numerator. But the denominator, the fact that there's this total energy pool, is model independent, just like this total this energy conserving delta function. Now let's try the classical analog of this problem. So instead of this quantum mechanical formula for how we compute the correlations, we're just going to solve the classical equations of motion perturbatively. So we're going to treat the nonlinear action as a source and use the Green's function to time evolve a second order correction to the density fluctuation. Plugging this into the three-point statistics, we again recover this total energy pole, but now we get three new kinds of poles. These poles are possible to reach at physical momenta and correspond to I'll come back to the folded shape. Now, what these poles correspond to is again related to an energy conserving delta function from scattering, but now they're related to the possibility that particles in the initial state decay. So one particle in the initial state decays to two particles in the final state, conserving total energy. This is possible in classical physics just through the decay of initial particles. But again, because this is not a scattering process, this delta function is replaced with just a power law suppression. But because this is physically possible, I can still reach this pole, giving enhanced signal at certain momenta. The appearance of all of these poles together is a reflection of a known property of scattering, which is that whenever you have one possible structure, say creation of particles from nothing, you always have the associated processes, one decaying to two producing one, or three annihilating to nothing. And the only difference between these processes is the number of particles in the initial state, which we can achieve by changing the sign of the energies. The reason that all of these possibilities happen classically comes back to this basic fact, which is that classical fluctuations had to have been present at earlier times than when we actually measure them. So in the past, these particles we observed existed, and therefore their physical existence meant that they could not only be produced, but they could also decay. And what we're seeing is that decay, the decays of the particle in the initial state in our final statistics. In contrast, the quantum mechanical problem corresponds to the vacuum, which by construction has no particles in it. And so even though all of these processes are allowed, both in quantum mechanics and classical physics, it's only the quantum mechanical vacuum that forbids these additional processes by forbidding particles in the initial state. So the fact that we don't get the poles associated with these processes is a reflection of the quantum vacuum and its uniqueness compared to classical physics. As promised, this difference can also be traced to a non-zero commutator in quantum mechanics. And in fact, you can trace this non-zero commutator for three points, say on the CMB sky, is a measurement of the non-zero commutator at the intersection of the path light cone of these three points. Now, to further understand this result, we want and make contact with Bell's inequalities, we'd like to understand the role of locality in this signal. In particular, Bell's inequalities are known to only hold in local hidden variables theories, but can be violated even classically if the theory is non-local. So can we find a non-local theory that's classical that allows us to reproduce the quantum mechanical result? The simplest way to do this is to focus on this positive frequency. So in particular, if we take a complex scalar field instead of a real scalar field, now we're allowed to have classical solutions that are complex. And so what we'll do is we'll just excite the positive frequencies. So we have positive and negative frequencies, but we'll just set the negative frequencies to zero. In addition, we need the evolution to respect this preference for positive frequencies. So what we'll do is we'll take the Green's function of the original theory and just by hand throw away the negative frequency component. As a result, we'll just make up a Green's function for the purposes of this model that propagates only the positive frequencies. When we do this, we get precisely what we predicted from the classical, the quantum theory. We predict a total energy pole in this three-point function and no additional poles. This pole here corresponds to one particle decaying into two antiparticles in this model for net creation of three antiparticles. So why is this theory non-local? Well, it's easiest to see by taking the times to be equal, so that the green, effective Green's function just looks like 1 over k. In position space, what this means is that space-like separated points have a non-zero Green's function connecting them. In particular, all space-like points have non-zero propagation, and it just goes like 1 over the distance between these points squared. Instead, if we want a local theory, that's why we needed the sign. The sign was necessary in a local theory so that when we take this time to zero, we get an analytic function of k, or more precisely, a delta function in space, so that space-like separated points don't have information propagated. When we put in this causal Green's function, even forcing the statistical fluctuations to prefer the positive frequency modes, we again recover these poles. Now this pole corresponds to two particles annihilating to produce one antiparticle. In this way, we see the non-trivial connection between causality and the presence of these poles. This connection is in fact the same connection that demands the presence of antiparticles in quantum field theory. In particular, we had this process corresponding to one particle decaying into two antiparticles. But because of the uncertainty principle, there's some probability that one of these antiparticles is outside the light cone with respect to the initial decaying particle. Now, by a Lorentz transformation, because these are outside the light cone or space-like separated, we can perform a boost which makes this picture look as follows. Two particles coming together and annihilating to form an antiparticle. And so Lorentz invariance is the thing that demands that whenever this process is possible, the other processes must happen as well, giving rise to these poles, these additional poles. Okay, so with my last bit of time, let's talk about the possible observational implications. So the key here is if we want to search for such a signal, is to be able to measure non-Gaussian statistics in either the cosmic microwave background or in the distribution of matter or galaxies in the universe. These non-Gaussian statistics, particularly the three-point function, is usually expressed in terms of what's called the bispectrum. So this is in Fourier space. I take those three points and now I Fourier transform this three-point function to a bispectrum. And using translation invariance and rotations, you find the following structure. So one, the sum of the Fourier modes equals zero. So it's like momentum conservation. This means that the three Fourier vectors form a closed triangle. The function that sits out front is a function only of the length of the edges of this triangle. So this function B depends only on the length of these different parts of the triangle. In addition, inflationary correlators are approximately scale invariant, so I can set one of the lengths of this vector, this triangle, to one, so that the dependence on the size of the triangle is trivial. As a result, the information depends only on the shape of this triangle, characterized in terms of these two vectors. As a result, a generic Bayes spectrum is encoded by two things. It's encoded by an amplitude, which is usually given the name FNL, and some shape function that encodes the non-trivial dependence on which triangle configurations gives most of the information. These shape functions can be given a dot product, a non-trivial dot product. In particular, there's an inner product between these shapes that characterizes whether these shapes are close to each other or far apart from each other. So in particular, when the cosine, as defined by this inner product, is close to zero, it means within that given a measurement of these two shapes in the data, we can easily tell them apart. In contrast, when the dot product is close to one, the data can't tell these two shapes apart very easily. Current constraints on non-Gaussianity are dominated by measurements from Planck, where they measure the three-point function in the CMB sky. These results are usually reported in terms of three conventional shape functions. The first is called the local shape. It's visualized here, where this enhancement in this corner corresponds to what's called the squeezed configuration, where one side of the triangle goes to zero. The next shape of interest is called the equilateral shape. As the name suggests, the dominant contribution to the equilateral shape comes from triangles where all three sides are equal, forming an equilateral triangle. And finally, there's the so-called orthogonal shape. The orthogonal shape is defined by this inner product, in particular that it's orthogonal in the sense of this inner product with respect to the equilateral shape. This shape gets contributions both in the equilateral triangle and in this squash triangle or this flattened triangle, where the length of two sides add up to the length of the third. The signature we're talking about with quantum versus classical is a distinction between equilateral configurations and these folded configurations. So this total energy pole is just a certain type of equilateral non-Gaussianity. So if we were to measure equilateral non-Gaussianity, it could be consistent with this quantum mechanical model. The presence of these classical poles corresponds to enhanced signal to noise in these folded configurations. In particular, the folded configuration is precisely the limit where this pole vanishes. Now our hope is that we'll be able to measure non-Gaussianity with future cosmological surveys. So ongoing measurements of the cosmic microwave background with a variety of experiments, including the upcoming Simons Observatory and CMB Stage 4, or through large-scale structure surveys like DESI, Euclid, SphereX, and potentially even 21-centimeter surveys like PUMA. These different experiments are projected to make improvements in the measurement of non-Gaussianity, and hopefully potentially by an up to an order of magnitude. The idea would be if we could measure these if we were to detect an equilateral shape, this could be used in conjunction with the absence of a pole in the folded configurations to give strong evidence for the quantum mechanical story. Okay, so my time is nearly up, so just I want to summarize. So the summary of the talk is this picture. Quantum mechanics, quantum mechanical vacuum fluctuations, corresponds to the creation of particles from nothing. Classical fluctuations include physical particles in the initial state, and thus also include the effect of decays in the from particles in the initial state, producing multiple particles in the final state. This total energy pole is a generic feature of non-Gaussianity, independent of the type of interaction, and is a reflection of energy conservation. This is the only kind of thing we find in the quantum vacuum fluctuations, But these decay processes lead to these additional poles and folded configurations that can that are associated with the fact that these are physical processes that can happen at physical energies. We also see that the fact that there's no classical version of this these only total energy poles is deeply tied to locality. And trying to avoid this possibility in a classical theory requires a breaking of locality. Altogether, this means that the measurement of primordial non-Gaussianity or a detection would enable a Bell-type test in cosmology. Okay, thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Dan. So let's all applaud either audibly or virtually, depending on muting yourself or not. So I'll applaud audibly. Thanks so much. Yeah, that was fantastic. So any questions for Dan? You can either just unmute yourself or you could, press the raise hand button. Either way is fine.
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
Measuring these poles will imply that either that the non-Gaussianity has classical origins, or it may have origins in some excited inflationary states, because they also, I think, have these kind of poles. But not observing them will uniquely vote for a Bunch Davies kind of inflationary state. Am I right?
Correct. Yeah. So indeed, quantum can give classical type correlations, but classical cannot give quantum type correlations. So an excited state in quantum mechanics can reflect the same kind of physics as a classical case.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So to follow up on that, what's the test you're doing? So if you see this large folded bispectrum, that could arise, you're saying quantum mechanically, if I have a different initial state, right?
Correct. So if you see the folded configuration, this was known before that if you saw the folded configuration, that's telling you something pretty dramatic about what's happening during inflation. That's not the conventional picture of vacuum fluctuations. What's the reverse here is that if you were to see equilateral non-Gaussianity with no enhanced folded configuration, that would tell you that it was quantum mechanics that was quantum vacuum fluctuations that was responsible for that non-Gaussianity. In particular, it's actually in most cases, this pole has actually enhanced signal to noise. So if you were to detect equilateral and then construct a measurement that's designed to pick out this pole, you should see much more signal to noise most of the time if it was classical, right? So it's not that it's some you need to make super duper precise measurements of the equilateral shape to know that it doesn't have this pole. Usually this pole is actually much larger signal to noise. So if you actually were deep down, I really believe it's classical fluctuations, then designing observables just to look for this pole are actually much more effective. And in principle, you can get much more signal to noise than looking for the equilateral ones.
Mm-hmm. Hey, great, thanks. Let's see, so I see in the chat that Robert Brandenberger has a question. Do you want to ask it, Robert, or should I?
Yeah, so are you sure that reheating can't destroy this nice quantum feature?
So at an exact level, no. And the reason is because of this picture I showed in terms of the difference between these two results. Let's see if I can find it. Being associated with the evolution, being a non-zero commutator at the intersection of the path light cone. So in particular, the evolution at reheating, when these points are now no longer causally connected, can't reproduce the structure of the poles. So, however, what could be worried about is whether it's close enough, it's not literally the same, but for the given the limited signal to noise of an actual experiment, that it might be hard to tell apart the kind of non-Gaussianity you generate at reheating from the kind of non-Gaussianity you generate from from interactions during inflation. So my understanding, or maybe said, in all examples I know of, there's kind of always an order one difference. So the cosine can be sort of not tiny, but not one. So it's usually like a half. So that means if I measured equilateral at 5 sigma, I can only rule out the reheating scenario at 2.5 sigma. Now, but in terms of like mathematically, can you make this the same? You can trace this to the analytic structure. So in particular, you cannot produce this total energy pull from reheating. So at the level of functions, you can never make these literally the same function. But from the point of view of data, you might have issues where you say, well, could I make it close enough that it's sort of confusion limited in some realistic experiment? That's some detail that we'd have to figure. That's some detail for future work to see how close these two things can get to each other.
Okay, any further questions for Dan? Okay, well, if not, so let's thank Dan again.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.